Welcome to this edition of In Tune with Opera Philadelphia. I'm Mike Bolton. Today we're meeting with James Darrah, the director of our festival production of Handel's Semele. Semele is not a piece that arrives frequently on the opera stage, and we're thrilled to have this Handel production as part of our festival. It's only the second time Opera Philadelphia has produced a Handel work in its history. James Darrah is a familiar face to Opera Philadelphia patrons. He directed the world premiere production of Missy Mazzoli and Royce Vavreck's Breaking the Waves, and came back last season to direct Nikita Pa, an evening of Poulenc works, as part of the 018 festival. We're thrilled to have him back and his distinctive vision for Handel's Semele, a production which he's done two other times, most recently with Opera Omaha. We sat down with him in Opera Philadelphia's rehearsal hall in the Academy of Music to talk to him about this production. Hello, James.
Hi.
How are you?
Good.
Thanks for being here. Yeah, last night was opening night.
Yes.
How was it?
Excellent. Yeah, it went really well. It's the cast and team assembled here is a really remarkable group of people. So it really felt good to, I think, do something that was about that collectivity and that group. And everybody from, obviously, the chorus and cast is first rate, but having the designers here, which is also unusual for a revival in some sense, but this was kind of not a normal revival. So they were all here making new work, and we changed a lot of things. And then the stage management team, the crew, everybody really is kind of functioning at the top of their game. So it's kind of what you always want.
Yeah, right. And everybody that I've talked to internally, everybody's just been excited by this production.
Awesome. Great.
From the very beginning, including, you may not know this, we have had three interns over the summer who were pulling apart black
paper
yeah. to fill the stage.
Yes.
And I think for them, even seeing the result on stage was sort of overwhelming, like, and because they're high school students. So wow, I had a part in this.
Yeah.
So,
and it looks so magical in a way that is not necessarily true up close.
Yeah.
The theater right. magic of just texture. And yeah, we wanted something that moved and had, you know, kind of felt in the vein of Handel's music, so.
So, Handel's Semele.
Yeah.
How did you first, what were the circumstances where you first really got to know this piece?
I have always been a big Handelian, you know, sort of fan and admirer of the work, and Handel was actually an access point into opera, because I had spent so many years way more interested in theater and performance and design, but also film, and opera was kind of a foreign thing to me even as I started grad school, and you know, it was kind of late to realize what the potential of opera could be. And I had spent a lot of time with mythology and Greek plays, and so because Handel was writing operas, or in this case an oratorio that involved Greek mythology, Roman mythology, I was completely thrilled by that, and you know, really interested in how you can put that on stage, or what that is. So in a way, I had been doing another Handel piece called Agrippina at the time, and it was about 2014. A conductor in Seattle, Stephen Stubbs, who had an early music group called Pacific Music Works and still does, and has worked with people like Amanda Forsyth, our Semele here, and they're all kind of part of that early music family. And he was really interested in producing Semele as a staged piece, and we had been working together, and so they invited me to come to Seattle, and the chorus was students from the university, and then the cast was all professional people that he had hired. So it was a really interesting experiment about kind of almost workshopping the piece for the first time and trying out some ideas, and I had never done it, and it ended up being an incredibly rewarding experience. And it was then a couple of years later in 2016 when Roger White's the general director of Opera Omaha, where I had been doing kind of like an artist residency every year and developing new work, we had invited David Devan to come out and see a production, and he kind of wrote back and said, I want to co-produce with this company, like, what do you guys have coming up? And that's when this production was sort of born, this co-production. And it was always kind of intended to be, in the same way that I feel like Handel was always rewriting things and kind of stealing arias from other things or custom tailoring something to the person that he was working with, which we know from revisions and different, you know, iterations of the same theme or musical themes. I wanted this production to do that and not feel like it was an exact replica of what we had made in 2016. And as a director also, then selfishly, it's amazing because you get to like fix things you didn't like, you know, like you get to go back in and look at that. And so, yeah, it was cool to come here and have that. I think Opera Philadelphia is unique in that they allowed that process to really take shape. Mm-hmm. And it's as much a new production as it is a collaboration with another company.
So you have a very distinct concept for this opera,
yeah,
which is goes beyond mythology,
yeah,
which I find fascinating. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I thought that it was really important to find a way, because it's written in this oratorio format and the chorus is so prominent, it reminds me a lot of Greek plays where the chorus is the catalyst that propels action forward. And the chorus is responsible for being our barometer of knowing how to feel about certain moments or certain things. And staging it is hard because there certainly is a narrative, but it's not necessarily always linear and it doesn't necessarily always resolve. You know, I think of Act One, one of the directorial things you have to solve is why suddenly the entire narrative pivots to Semele's sister Ino and this unrequited love for Athamas, and you spend a huge portion of Act One in that. And so I think one of the ways that we approached that was to think about, could we involve physicality and dance, but not in a way where we're stopping narrative to have a dance, but actually imbue the whole piece with a sense of what does physical movement help us convey in addition to a great performer? And I always was kind of adamant that it not take away from the piece, but in also staging choruses, it was amazing here because the chorus learned kind of complicated choreography from Gustavo Sansano, who's, you know, a celebrated modern dance choreographer, and his stuff is not easy in just the way he thinks about movement, but he responded to the structure of Handel in an interesting way, and some of the repetition and the way that those things manifested. I feel like here we were able to expand that a little bit more. So I think having that room to kind of play and experiment is also so important when you're doing a piece that's hundreds of years old, that you find something that, you know, is a gamble in a way to see if it will pay off. And certainly having Daniela Mack then sing, you know, this entire incredible aria she sings in Act One, and have Lindsay, who's our associate choreographer, but also dancing in the whole piece, to have her sort of present. And that evolution was very much found here in the rehearsal room of how to sort of pair those two things.
Amazing.
As opposed to other things like when Juno's supposed to become Ino, and usually you just take the singer who's singing Juno, who was Ino, and dress her up again as Ino. But I was like, well, we've already seen you do that. So it's way more interesting that you remain this sort of queen of the gods and you puppet the Ino dancer around. And that we kind of played with that in a really fun way. Like, what does that mean?
And it's an absolutely brilliant concept. It works so brilliantly. And I know that everybody who sees it is talking about it after.
Awesome.
Because it's really been a key moment for the opera.
Yeah.
Or the staging. So you are setting this in,
I like to say it's
time?
Like, it's in it's in kind of an imagined time. I mean, that always sounds, people are always like, oh, it's timeless. And I'm like, well, that doesn't really mean anything. I think it's not, it is very much rooted in sort of ritualization, right? And it kind of is a postmodern take on Greek theater and ritualization. So our costume designer Sarah Schussler has this task of, how do you put Jupiter and Juno on stage, right? And how do you make that something that's believable, but also they mention being in human forms, so you have to acknowledge that, but they can't seem too familiar or mundane. And you have to play with this balance of mortal and immortal in a really decisive way, I think, from a design perspective. So that's kind of why we thought more like, what do we want each world to feel like? Like, can the world of mortals, that all the text is about these religious rites and profaning sacred rites, and we started thinking about, like, you know, religious fervor and this obsessiveness with the gods, and all of the design then for Act One became this kind of dark, sort of heavy world. And then also, interestingly, like, had elements of burn, of texture, and almost prophetically, you know, in a way foreshadowing Semele's demise in the very first act. So all of that world then totally transforms into something that's kind of still simple and minimalist in a nice way, but it is lush and light and airy and beautiful, and all of the costumes suddenly become really expensive, gorgeous silk that we found in Los Angeles. You know, it's like it completely changes in terms of its stuff, and these people that you've seen everybody worshiping. Act One has more tragedy in it, but we really, in this, especially in this iteration, wanted to find the comedy. And to me, there's a lot of comedy in that you've heard about these gods and this worship, and then you go up there and they're just having the same human problems all the mortals are having, and they're sort of flippant immortals up there arguing all the time.
That's brilliant. Now that you mention that, that makes complete sense, and I think that answers maybe some questions that I had when I'm sitting in the dress rehearsals. You know, I was mentioning to some of our, I had to do a pre-performance talk last night, and I said, you know, think of Act One as being, with Cadmus being Jon Snow, and it's sort of like King of the North section. It's dark and it's dreary. And then Act Two, once we get into Jupiter's world, or this palace world that he's created for Semele, it's more of like an elven thing from Lord of the Rings, yeah, slash something from Game of Thrones also. But I'm really curious about, as these characters evolve, what do you think is the motivation for someone like Jupiter beyond sex with Semele?
I mean, certainly that's a lot of his motivation, but I think, you know, the piece, and Handel, I find it fascinating that we actually know very little about his personal life. And, you know, we know some things, but we know very little about it. But you hear things in the music that indicate that he experienced at some point in his life profound love and loss, right? And unrequited love. Like, I don't think you can write music like that and not have felt some of those things. And what's interesting is that the gods in the piece experience a huge range of human emotions. So Jupiter mentions, I'm in human form for you, Semele. I'm going to appear as this human, but I don't have man's falseness. But then Jupiter experiences what it's like to be in this human body, and is also wrestling with some of the same things that I feel like are familiar emotional currents to us as an audience. But we also spent a lot of time, I spent a lot of time in this rehearsal process with Alec Schrader and Daniela Mack, our Jupiter and Juno, really talking about how to make sure that what comes through was a sense of, when you're immortal, you have a different set of high stakes. Mm-hmm. They don't die. So in a way, I said to Juno, you know, how many times has he done this? And so when she first comes in, it's sort of like, oh, I know this game, right? And I said, there's a sparring quality of almost being so bored up in Olympus that you're going to try to raise the stakes of the game, almost like Dangerous Liaisons or something, and see how each other can respond to it. So Jupiter brings Semele, but then he builds her this palace and brings her up to Olympus, and he won't make her immortal because that's not part of the deal, but he gives her things and then guards her palace with dragons that won't let Juno inside to go strangle her to death. It was interesting to see Daniela play, rather than just play the one card of vengeance, which I feel like is a very short-lived thing. Daniela finds all of these colors of almost enjoying, relishing this opportunity to contrive this unbelievable plot that ends in Semele destroying herself. It's like, you know, it has that Dangerous Liaisons quality, or like, we were even joking, like Cruel Intentions, you know, which is derived from that. Like, it has this level of these two people at the height of their power that have nothing to lose, right? They're immortal beings, but there's an acknowledgement between them of this ongoing, never-ending game. She's always going to be jealous, and she's always going to try to one-up anything that he does, and he raises the stakes, so she has to meet him. And that's her final aria is, you know, mm-hmm, I win. It's going to be great to go back to all the other gods with them knowing that I just beat you.
What do you think happens to Jupiter after this?
I mean, in mythology, he actually, so Semele, when she dies, is pregnant, and he actually takes the fetus and stores it in his thigh, and that becomes Bacchus. So this is the first time that we actually put Bacchus into the show. So the entire ending has changed from previous iterations. And it was important, I think, for the end. We talked a lot about, you know, there is this sense that I feel like is also incredibly true today of we experience something horrific, we immediately think about our own fate and our own well-being, and then if we're distracted by something, we can easily move on. Mm-hmm. And there's this thing at the end of the piece, there's almost a false ending that's completely tragic and devastating. But then the gods come down and say, no, but we have this new god of wine and, you know, sex and power, and this Bacchus figure is going to incite all of this ecstatic, you know, they talk about endless pleasures now going to be ours, and we're just going to forget all of our troubles. And there is this kind of blind willingness for this whole cycle to repeat, for all of these same things are going to happen again, and we're going to just kind of wipe the slate clean. And I think it's both ironic and kind of devastating at the same time at the end, you know, from that point of view. And that was important to, rather than the chorus just singing happy, happy at the end and having this enlightenment ending of everything gets tidied up, I was like, we're not going to tie a bow on it. It has to literally be that human nature thing of we're going to be horrified about really tragic events in our society and in our community on a 2-week time lapse. Mm. And then once that's up, we're going to move on to the next thing. Right.
How did the Bacchus idea kind of come?
Yeah, it came out. I mean, I think Lindsay Mathias, who's our choreographer and our dancer, is really incredible. And for the first time, I kind of also thought, we were kind of talking about it, and I said, you know, she plays this sort of double of Ino and is evocative of Ino in Act 1, and then is puppeted by Juno in Act 2 and is present throughout the piece in that way. And I thought there was something really beautiful also reading about how Bacchus was often depicted as kind of non-binary. I mean, Bacchus has male depictions, and later in the Roman depictions becomes kind of almost feminine in certain artistic depictions of him. And so I kind of loved the idea of this female dancer, you know, almost in a gender neutral sort of way, being this kind of enigmatic Bacchus figure, and that we needed to see that person emerge from the ashes. We needed to see what is described to us, but also see the chorus react to that, you know, and that enabled us to kind of go down this road of like tying up Tim Meads as Athamas, his storyline, and Cadmus being sort of broken, and this leader you've seen in Act 1 is completely now replaced by this new person. Mm-hmm. So I liked this quality of, you know, this fervent group of worshiping people of the gods now have a new god to attach themselves to and a new leader to attach themselves to, and the whole cycle's going to repeat.
It's brilliant. I know I can't ask a director this, but
you can ask me anything.
Is there a favorite moment, or was there a moment during the rehearsal process that was really inspiring or fulfilling over this process?
Yeah, I think everybody, every single member of the cast, and I have to say, and I mean every single member of the cast, including every single member of the chorus, because I think both here having the amazing chorus that we had, but also a lot of my sort of belief in what a chorus is and should be, is that the chorus has to be treated like individual artists, and every single person has to be directed and have a track and have thoughts and have things that they want, and it's that collective whole that then becomes really powerful. So we spent a lot of time on that with the group, that it wasn't just like a group of 20 robots running around the stage. It was sort of how do we motivate you as a force, both individually and then as a collective whole. All of those people had different moments that were really illuminating, where suddenly something that I was either throwing at them or Lindsay was throwing at them physically clicked and made sense. Realizing that Daniela was really good at learning some of the choreography, and so there's moments where she and Lindsay do exactly the same thing, it was like suddenly an aha moment in the room where we saw who those two people were, and we saw this silenced woman, this embodiment of her sort of doing things, but that then Daniela would take that on, I thought was amazing. I had no idea she could dance, so it was kind of incredible to see her learn that. And, you know, similarly, like, to me, the end, he, you know, was sort of like, well, what if I became the new cult leader at the end? And I was like, we were kind of said it jokingly, and I'm like, oh, actually, Athamas should come back. That, you know, there were these moments of everybody, I think, being invested in a way. And Alec, too, I have to say, he has brought out something that is the first time I've seen Jupiter be almost like Puck in Midsummer, this kind of impish, like, and I thought, and I'm like, it's brilliant because he's so bored that of course he's showing off his new mortal toy to the immortals, you know? So little things like all of them laughing when he says, you're mortal and you need time to rest. And they're all like, huh, amateur, you know, we don't need that, but you do. Those were all new discoveries.
This moment in our conversation embodies what Opera Philadelphia and O the O festivals are all about.
Awesome. Yeah.
Giving artists the opportunities to engage in art and help them do their best work possible. Because everything I'm hearing from you, one embodies that, but also, you know, there are directors that don't really take that much time with chorus.
Yeah. And or you're just not, frankly, given much time with chorus.
Right. That too.
Yeah.
But then also this sort of very much collaborative sounding opportunity that everybody had, invest them in the final product, but also stretches their artistic muscles in ways that they may not have the opportunity to in other locations.
Yeah. And it gives them ownership of the piece in a way too. Yeah. And I think the chorus in just what Handel wrote on the page, the chorus is the backbone of the score. And if you delete that, you're gutting the piece. And there's something really amazing about having a chorus that is so dedicated to being a good musicians and good performers, yes, but also dedicated to illuminating and unearthing things within the piece that are either things that I knew we wanted to try to do or that were total discoveries. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what's amazing about doing a piece that's hundreds of years old. You find ways to illuminate it, even if your design is not, it's not done intentionally to be super contemporary and look like it's 2019, but you're creating a world and telling a story that has mythological context that still feels relevant to us.
So this is your third appearance with Opera Philadelphia.
Yeah.
One with Breaking the Waves, which is just such an extraordinary, mind-blowing thing for everybody involved in so many different ways. You came back last year for Nikki Tepa, and then you're back again for Semele. Mm-hmm. What does Philadelphia mean to you, and Opera Philadelphia mean to you?
Yeah, I mean, I am incredibly grateful to have been here for 3 years, especially since all of those projects are very, very, very different. And certainly the working relationships on new work, I hadn't really done many world premieres at that time. And so Breaking the Waves was, for me, both personally illuminating, but also just, again, that sense of collaboration and coming to a city to work to unearth something, a work of art that is the sum of all of its parts and personnel, and that collaborative environment was really amazing. And I have to say, last year was also for me, like, again, the collaboration thing. I had never worked with Pat Rosette, and now I just think she's really amazing. That's Opera Philadelphia that put us all together for the first time. And also that was, like, in so many ways an experiment, and that I feel like the festival gives artists the ability to try things where, you know, you're going to discover the things that work and the things that don't, and know how to then move forward and tailor and think about it. And Semele this year is then completely different from Breaking the Waves, obviously, but also that collaborative spirit is still there. So I think that sense of community of a company that from everyone in the staff to the casts that they bring in, you know, these artists, everybody's interested in sort of digging in a way. And that's really rare.
You've been listening to a conversation with James Darrah, the director of Handel Semele, which is part of Opera Philadelphia's 019 Festival, our yearly festival which allows you to binge watch opera. In this season's festival, not just Handel Semele, but we have Prokofiev's rarely performed Love for Three Oranges in the Academy of Music. We have Philip Venables and Ted Huffman's world premiere opera, Denise and Katya, at the Suzanne Roberts Theater on Broad Street. And then, as part of the Fringe Arts Festival, we have Joseph Koechler's Let Me Die. Along with those operas, we have recitals given by Curtis Institute of Music alumni Karen Slack and Rachel Sternberg as part of Curtis in Concert. And then, after all the operas, there is Late Night Snacks being presented by the Bearded Ladies Cabaret Troupe. For more information on all of our operas this season, which also include Verdi's Requiem in January and Puccini's Madame Butterfly in April and May, visit our website, operaphila.org. Thanks for listening to this podcast. My name is Mike Bolton. If you have any questions or comments about this podcast, please feel free to email us at info@operaphila.org.